And good morning, everybody. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGJF, Kyle High with you this morning on this Wednesday morning here. Not too bad out there. It'll be still a little cloudy out there, but we'll clear out these clouds. But we'll only get up to a high of about 60 today. So joining us here now for Greenside Up here this morning, we have James Coover and Jesse Gilmore. And guys, good morning. How are you doing today?
Doing good. Good morning.
Pretty good.
All right. So again, James, I don't know if you're quite ready yet. We can always talk to Jesse here to start this segment here. That way you can finish getting ready. So we'll go ahead and start with Jesse here. And Jesse, a few things you've already told me you want to talk about today. You want to talk about leaf anatomy.
Yes. So I've gotten a couple of calls in the last few weeks of homeowners wanting me to come out and get a look at their evergreen shrubs. And for the most part, it's ended up being hollies, but these could also include boxwoods and yews. Although the problem that I've been called out to see is almost exclusively on hollies. The symptoms that I've been asked to look at usually include very dry leaves. They look kind of crispy and brown, like some kind of blight has hit them. And what it ends up being is actually super interesting and kind of a unique look into how plants use water and carbon dioxide in their life cycle. It basically is the result of plants sweating out too much water. So leaves have pores, a lot like human skin does, on the bottom of the plant in order to take up carbon dioxide when they're going through photosynthesis, because or respiration. The carbon dioxide is converted into oxygen, and then the oxygen is released through those pores. And they have to be open in order to take up the carbon dioxide. The problem is that while they're open, water from the leaves can evaporate out of it. And usually you're going to see most of the evaporation in the summer, but you're also going to get replacement water in the forms of occasional rains. So the water balance typically ends up being pretty neutral. However, in the winter, especially for evergreens like hollies, dry air is continually being blown by the dry winds, and this causes problems with water evaporation. So how it works is that usually when water evaporates out of the leaf, the immediate air surrounding the leaves becomes more humid, and kind of physics related, the more water that's in the air immediately surrounding the leaf, the harder it is for more water to evaporate. So basically, by increasing the humidity directly around the leaf, it limits water loss in the plant. With the dry winter winds that we usually get, the water that is supposed to stay around the leaf and limit water loss is carried away and replaced by drier air. Where the water can continue to evaporate out, it's carried away, evaporate out, it's carried away. Ultimately, what we're seeing on evergreen shrubs like hollies is basically the plant sweating its leaves to death. Now, usually, this is not going to harm the plant. They will push out new growth in the spring as it warms up. If you are seeing symptoms like this on your shrubs, keep a close eye on it here in the next month or so. As the temperatures warm up, you will start seeing new buds forming on the branches, and you should start seeing new leaves push out too. Most of the time, when you have foliar problems, they're going to be isolated to the leaves and not going to be a systemic problem. And occasional foliar problems won't be detrimental to the long-term health of the tree, shrub, or it might be a little more of a problem on herbaceous plants, but woody plants like trees and shrubs will usually recover from a foliar problem or two. The thing that you definitely want to keep an eye out for is recurring patterns of environmental problems or diseases, because if you start piling stress on stress on stress, then you can weaken the plant and make it more susceptible to other problems that could end up killing the plant. But that's what we've been seeing over the last couple of weeks on evergreen plants. And it's a really unique look into how plants go through the act of respiration and how that can affect water balance in the plant.
It's just, it's interesting to think about how a plant basically, like you said, could basically kind of sweat itself to death. I mean, and that's probably why they need plenty of moisture, correct?
Yeah, and it looks super disturbing to homeowners, especially if they've never seen it before. Like, this winter, very out of character in terms of how cold and windy it was, especially during that week-long span in February when we had the the gas crisis.
We don't talk about that time.
Yeah, but winds like that, like, a lot of people, and especially me, when I was taking classes at K-State for this, and anatomy and physiology of plants, even if it's cold, the water can still evaporate out of the leaves because of the natural radiant heat of the light that's hitting the leaves.
Yeah, it's much brighter at that point because of all that snow, and then when the sun decides to come out, it gets even brighter. It's not blinding, but for a plant, it's really hard on them.
Yeah, you're not only getting the natural light that's shining down from the sun, you're also getting reflected light off of the snow. So basically, you're getting a double whammy of light, and light is basically energy that excites molecules in the leaves, and basically, the faster they're moving, the more heat they're giving off, and the more likely it is that water is evaporating out of it. In winter, you have snow, so you have a little bit of precipitation, and you can kind of maintain the water balance with that, but because people aren't, you know, giving the plants supplemental water during the winter, you don't want your hoses or spigots freezing up and cracking, so most people don't run their water to their gardens in the winter, which probably the right choice, especially this winter. You don't have a ton of water going into the plant compared to what's coming out of it. And for deciduous plants and any herbaceous plants that you might have, they're usually cut back to the ground, so they're not losing the water that evergreens would. And that's why you see this problem almost exclusively on evergreens. They will drop their leaves if they lose enough water. The leaves that are affected on the tips and the edges, because that's the part that's farthest away from where the water is coming into the leaf, or the petiole of the leaf, the stem. And the parts closer to the petiole will still look fine. But with enough water loss, they will drop and kind of give the appearance of a disease.
So again, that's still pretty interesting to me. I guess I just never thought of that because obviously we know plants and trees are living things. It's just, I guess, never thought of that. Like, if it gets so much sunlight, like you said, everything gets going in there and it starts letting off heat, which means it's starting to dry out the plant, which is why they always need a lot of moisture, and why they tell you to water, you know, don't overlog the plant when you're watering it, but don't let it basically dry out either. So,
yep. So it's all a balancing act.
It definitely is a balancing act when it comes to nature. And we'll go ahead and discuss your second topic here, and we'll come to James in the second part of the show. Wanted to talk about spring bulbs.
Sure. So in southeast Kansas and northeastern Oklahoma, you should be seeing any spring bulbs that you plant come up right now. They are in their flowering period, especially daffodils. Daffodils seem to be the most common spring bulb that I've seen in our area. There's also tulips, crocus, lots of bulbs that have been dormant over the last 9 months because they're usually spring flowering and then they die back. The only one that doesn't really follow that pattern is irises, which flower for multiple growing seasons. I have gotten some calls about some unwanted spring bulbs in people's yards, and specifically this is going to be wild onions, or a similar allium species, allium being the name of the onion genus. And it is showing up in a lot of people's yards. And people are very curious about how to control it, because it grows much, much faster than surrounding turf grass. You get these pockets of really tall wild onions that outgrow pretty much everything around them, and it looks like kind of an overgrowth in a yard, and makes it very uneven.
It's basically overcompeting. It's beating out the grass around it.
Yep, especially if your turf grass yard is Bermuda grass, which is not in its active growing period right now. Fescue, you might be able to see similar growth rates as the temperature warms up a little bit, but wild onions and other species like that will always have a head start. They are also bulbs, which is kind of why I brought them up in the spring bulb section. And that makes it a little tricky on how to control it. They are not going to be nearly as affected by herbicide as herbaceous plants will be because of the method in which they basically store nutrients and resources. The leaves, or the basically what are the shoots that come up out of the soil, are very waxy. And so that makes it hard for herbicide to be effective on the leaves. You need to basically cut them and then apply the herbicide. And it needs to be a broadleaf selective herbicide. You don't really want to be spraying Roundup or any other non-selective herbicide on your yard unless you're okay with killing the grass that's immediately surrounding it. However, my recommendation, because I am always a forager, is to use wild onions. Wild onions can basically be used the same way as chives in any recipes that you might have. So if you just go out and cut off the overgrowth on the wild onions, you can use them in recipes like you would chives. They can be misidentified as bunching tall fescue. And I know I've fallen prey to that a couple of times in my own yard. I have patches of grass that kind of look like wild onions. The way that you would be able to tell whether or not they're wild onions is to tear off part of the leaves and smell them. If they smell like onions, they're onions. if they don't smell like anything, it's likely going to be a bunching turf grass like tall fescue, where it basically grows in patches instead of spreading. So you will get, like, not necessarily uneven areas, but you'll get spots that are actively growing in a Bermuda grass yard, for example, if certain tall fescue spots have taken and established. But for the most optimal control, and people really don't want to hear this, the best control option for wild onions is to pull them or dig them, so that they are not coming back year after year and month after month as you try mowing them down and keeping the lawn consistently at the same height, because they're going to have very different growing patterns, and it's going to be a struggle keeping everything looking consistent.
Yeah, and you're going to have that one part of the yard that where the grass, or quote-unquote grass, looks higher than the rest, but it's because it just grows at a higher rate, correct?
Mm-hmm, yep. And in a couple of months, they won't be growing nearly as much as they are right now. This is their primary growing season. And if you can outlast them for the first couple of months, it should be fine after that. Now, assuming that, you know, you don't kill them with herbicide or pull them up, they will be coming back year after year after year. They are perennial. Bulbs are very long-lived because of the stem, and it's modified. It's a modified stem. It's designed to hold water and nutrients for basically periods of drought or low soil fertility. So even if you think that, you know, it's super hot, it's going to not drown. The opposite of drown. It's going to dehydrate the plants to the point where they won't come back. Not quite, because of the modified stem. So pulling maybe herbicide if you want to apply it multiple times, but pulling or continuous mowing, especially during the hot periods, will be the best option for control.
Oh, and like saying you can pull it, that's one of those things, you could pull it, you could actually use it though, correct?
Yeah.
Get yourself some free onions, I guess. So
yeah. The one thing that I will mention, wild onions are not nearly as large as cultivated onions or other types of bulb, onion bulbs. They're going to be about the size of maybe a quarter, maybe a half dollar. They don't get very big at all, so don't dig them up expecting for a full meal.
Right.
They're more of a garnish than anything else.
No, not a bad garnish, though. So.
Nope.
All right, well, Jesse, lots of good stuff there for you. If anybody has any questions, though, about what you've talked about today, how can they get a hold of you?
Email, jr637@ksu.edu. Phone, 620-724-8233, or our new Facebook group, Gardening and Landscapes in the Wildcat Extension District.
All right, sounds good. And we'll come over here to James. James, don't have a lot of time here yet, but let's kind of just preview, what are you going to be talking about here in the second part of our program?
Yeah, so today I'm going to be talking, first I'm going to start off with talking about the wheat crop, basically an update of what's going on out there. A little bit disease look is really what we're looking at this point during the year. And then also kind of want to talk a little bit about the value of poultry litter. And so we're putting a lot of poultry litter on before the corn crop. There's corn being planted today, quite honestly. But kind of what is the value of that poultry litter? Why do we use it here? And what is the nutrient content with inside of it? So,
all right. So good stuff there for you. And that's coming up in the second part of our program. So be sure to listen in. We're going to go ahead and take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll have news at the top of the hour. And then we will have our second part of Greenside Up this morning. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF. And good morning. Welcome back to Greenside Up here on the Mighty 690 KGGF. Kyle High with you this morning. And we're going to head to James Coover here in just a moment. But Jesse Gilmore, Jesse, you had one more thing you wanted to talk about real quick.
Yes. So the K-State Garden Hour is back in full swing from last year. We have a webinar via Zoom next week. It's on raised bed and container gardening, which is a super popular topic, especially for people who don't have a ton of space to garden, especially for like apartment gardening and balcony gardening, stuff like that. You can register for that. If you haven't registered for K-State Garden Hours in the past couple of weeks to a month, if you register, you will get a recording, even if you can't make it. And you can do that on the KSU Horticulture and Natural Resources page.
All right, so be sure to check that out. And now we'll go over to James Coover. And James, good morning. How are you doing today?
Doing good. Good morning.
Well, it's good to see you today. I didn't see you guys a couple of weeks ago. I was on vacation, so it's good to have you in studio. And we'll talk about a few things here. And the first thing I want to talk about, we were talking about it off air, about how the wheat is doing right now. And it's actually not too bad as of right now, correct?
Yeah, so we're actually looking at a pretty good wheat year, honestly. And so that hard freeze that we got, it didn't really affect our wheat as much as it did Western Kansas. Basically, the snow cover helped protect it. And so I haven't hardly seen any freeze damage, any serious freeze damage.
It was kind of like an insulin, basically, to keep things down there warm. That way, the air did not basically get into it.
Yes, yeah. And really, we've had a little bit on the drier side of a winter overall, although it rained, 7 inches not very long ago. Right. But overall, and that really helps our wheat more than the rest of the state. Because so when the whole state is a little bit in a drought, wheat in southeast Kansas does better. So far, I mean, we're looking at a pretty good wheat crop. I mean, and as long as the nitrogen gets on it and we have pretty favorable weather for the next couple of months, I mean, we should see some good yields.
And like I said, just kind of going over some things, that the ground soil is actually pretty warm right now, isn't it?
Yes, and so wheat right now is going really fast, as you can tell out there. And so basically when the soil gets over 50 degrees or so, that's when the wheat really starts to take off. Being a kind of a cold season plant, it's likely getting around to feek 6, which basically means jointing. Feek 6 is, I mean, the feek level is just an agronomist term of the stage of production. So its sensitivity to cold increases greatly, but it'll still be pretty resistant temperatures even into the mid-20s. And so we're pretty much past that, hopefully, weather-wise. But this is the point where it starts to shoot up that little joint that will eventually become the stalk for the head. So it really increases with its nitrogen uptake, and it becomes more difficult to fertilize it because running over that joint can kind of crush it. So we're really at a point when we can start to see some yellow wheat, which is most likely nitrogen or sulfur deficiencies. However, it could be some other stuff that I want to talk about today. Basically, mosaic viruses or the barley yellow dwarf virus. Mosaic viruses are spread by a swimming fungus. It seems odd that a fungus can swim, but right. Yeah, it's a zoospore underneath the soil that will carry this virus from plant to plant, which is why it occurs in wet spots too. The barley yellow dwarf, however, that comes from above the soil. That's an aphid that carries it around. The bird cherry oat aphid is a really cold tolerant aphid, and there's some other mites and other things that like the cold. But this aphid, it often occurs on early planted wheat, and so infection that occurs in the fall is usually much more severe. At this point during the year, doing that preventative spraying that sometimes farmers do isn't really going to help the barley yellow dwarf. If it gets infected now, by the time it heads out, it's not going to be much of an issue. Barley yellow dwarf and mosaic viruses and even nitrogen deficiency, they all kind of look very similar when you're just driving by. Basically, it's yellow spots within the field.
Right.
If you get up there and look closer, mosaic viruses kind of have a splotchy look to them, while barley yellow dwarf has yellow leaf ends, but they're also kind of neurotic and purple. So there are some minor differences you can tell if you go out in the field, you pick them up and you really look at them and look at your picture comparisons. You can see what's going on there. And of course, prevention of all this stuff has a lot to do with varieties and proper pest management.
And that's what I was about to ask you. Is there anything that else that farmers need to be looking out for?
So, besides the viruses, we also have the funguses. The funguses are coming. They're already kind of swarming around southern Oklahoma and in Texas. And so the fungus I'm talking about, of course, is the rust diseases. That's the major yield taker from when it comes to wheat, is the rust. Generally, we start to see this stuff around mid-April. And so when it just starts to get a little bit warmer, the stripe rust is what we see first. There's stripe rust, leaf rust, stem rust. Stripe rust is the one, and it likes, 50, 60 degrees, high humidity, and so that's the one that we see first. Rust doesn't survive the winter. It actually blows in from Texas every year. It migrates like the geese do. So we actually look at Texas. What's happening there determines how bad of a rust year we're going to have. Right now, it's kind of dry down there, and that hard freeze that got all the way into Texas kind of knocked out their power. That actually set the rust back some, too. And so we're expecting a pretty light year, but that does not mean that we're going to have a light rust year. It just means that we're expecting it, because there have been years where we thought it wasn't going to be bad, and then we had a really bad rust outbreak, and sometimes vice versa, too. So we'll just kind of have to monitor it and see what happens. So if farmer out there sees something that looks like stripe rust over the next couple of weeks, please let me know. There's all kinds of maps I need to update. I need to tell the state agronomist. We can put that out there so that way other farmers know that their rust is coming. In southeast Kansas, we're sort of at the forefront of all of this for the rest of the state. We always get the things first before everyone else does. And so the importance of our reporting is important for the rest of the state, because they need to know.
Absolutely. And we're talking about wheat there. Just a quick question now for farmers. What does it look like when rust gets into the wheat?
And so rust is the different kinds of rust, but the ones that we're looking for right now is going to be stripe rust. And that actually looks like rust. It's a reddish orange color. There's discoloration on the leaf, kind of goes in stripes down the leaf ends. You'll usually see it on the lower canopy first, and so basically the wheat that's closer to the ground where the humidity is higher, and it takes about 2 weeks or so from when a wheat rust spore comes in to when it hatches and actually creates a rust pustule. So when you see those reddish brown stripes, that's often not the good indication. Resistant varieties to rust will make that discoloration look different. And so if it's a resistant variety, like Everest, which is our most common wheat planted around here, it won't be quite as red. but it's still a pretty good indication.
All right. And also, we're talking about what you're wanting to talk about today is also the value of poultry litter.
Yeah, so right now, farmers are out there planting corn. And it might be a little bit wet on the southern side of the listening area, but on the northern side, they're playing corn. And it is early, but they always plant corn early, and there's nothing, you know. It's just the way that it is. If the ground is dry, at the end of March, they're going to plant corn.
Kansas is very interesting. It's just, I mean, it's a big, pretty decent-sized state, but it just kind of just split up very wildly.
Yes, yeah. It's very regional about what farmers do and when. So if they see their neighbor planting corn, of course, they're going to plant corn, too. Right. So, but the soil temperatures are getting pretty close. Usually we want them above 55 degrees for uniform germination and all that, the population control. And we're getting pretty close to that, I would say, somewhere in the low 50s. Hopefully sometime in next week when we get our 70 degree weather, we'll get that up and get that corn out of the ground quickly. So, but when it comes to planting corn, we also got to talk about poultry litter, because we use a lot of poultry litter when it comes to corn. Probably more than we do with any other crop, honestly, just because of the time frame. And we like to till before corn. So we use a fair amount of poultry litter around here. And the reason is because of the industries in Arkansas and Missouri. Because of the huge poultry houses out there and the environmental laws out there, we end up shipping a lot of poultry litter here. Basically, they've really saturated their soils around there with phosphorus and potassium. And it kind of makes the poultry litter cheap. In an odd way, because they can't use as much of it, and we don't have the laws here, and also we have a desperate need for phosphorus and potassium, so it gets shipped here. Its litter contains pretty much all the nutrients. I mean, it's litter, it's manure, so it contains everything from nitrogen, which is 20% organic nitrogen, or 20% inorganic nitrogen, 80% organic. Phosphorus, potassium, sulfur, zinc, magnesium, iron, most of the other micros. It's got pretty much everything in it. So it really is a complete nutrient source. However, the nutrient can vary widely. It's most places should give you a litter test and let you know what the nutrient content is inside of it. But without that, you really have absolutely no guarantee. It could be as low as 25 pounds of nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium to well over 100 of that. So it's four or five times the difference sometimes in this litter. So it can be hard to fertilize with it because you don't actually know how much you're going to apply without a nutrient test. However, it can be a really cheap fertilizer source. But requires specialized equipment, because those spreader trucks, most of the time people just get it from the co-op or whatever, because they're not going to buy a litter truck for this one application.
Right.
Yeah, but they're great big trucks, and they're kind of expensive. So.
And so why is litter over-applied in areas close to the poultry industry?
I would say it's largely because it's expensive to transport. Like I was saying before, it's about half water. I mean, there's a lot of water in chicken manure. So when it comes to delivery, the application rate, you're talking 1 to 2 tons, and half that is water. So you can't fit a whole lot in a truck, but those trucks are huge too. So it takes a lot, which is why usually you'll see it piled up in the edges of fields in the fall. Because that's when they can ship that stuff out. They pile up at the edge of the field, and then they use it in the spring before the corn. And that often not is where the issues come from, is actually piling up of the chicken litter and the environmental concerns with that. But it's partly is because, you know, it's expensive to transport, so therefore it becomes cheaper here because they can't use as much of it over there. And it's should be applied based upon nitrogen, or based upon the need of the nitrogen. But really, ideally speaking, we should be applying it based upon the phosphorus, because it has such a low nitrogen content in comparison to phosphorus. That doesn't always happen with application. We tend to overload our soils with phosphorus and potassium when it comes to litter application. And so it is the one thing that we really kind of need to be careful with in future aspects. But
And the other thing is, how do farmers keep from over-application from happening then?
And so, really, soil sampling, knowing exactly how much phosphorus and potassium you have in your soil. If you have a history of, you put down 2 tons of litter every year on your corn, 1 ton to the soybeans, or it's just every single year you put it around a base amount, but you don't actually know how much phosphorus and potassium is in the soil, you would be surprised, because a lot of it's going to end up being saturated in those two. A 2-ton litter application could be easily 100 pounds of phosphorus and potassium, but the removal rate from the crop is only going to be 30 to 40. So you're over-applying by 60 pounds, which over the first couple of years, probably not a big deal, but over a longer period, that's really going to make a big difference. And so at this point, though, considering it costs a lot more to transport that stuff, just a basic nitrogen application is just going to be cheaper anyway, honestly, than going with the whole chicken litter route. So
again, lots of good stuff there. And as we were talking to Jesse earlier, if anybody would like to get a hold of you, James, how can they do that if they have questions about what we've talked about today or maybe any other kind of questions?
They can get a hold of us calling any of the local extension offices. The number for Girard is 620-724-8233.
All right. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for coming in today. Lots of great information out there. Be sure to give them a call if you have any questions. They are more than ready to help you guys out if you have any questions you have of them. So, guys, again, thank you so much for coming in today. We really do appreciate it, and we will talk to you guys here again in a couple of weeks.
Sounds good.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to go ahead and take a break, and when we come back, we'll start. We won't have open line quite yet. We will have midweek Medicare with Skank Insurance of Independence. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF.